And welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
And I'm Happy Pay Darian.
That's right. We've got a lot of great great stories for you. We've got Win7 API packs.
We have Spec Sharp
and Boogie.
Yep.
And we've got some Expression and Silverlight goodies. And
yep. And there's always the historical debugger.
That's right. That's right. So let's jump right into it. So first of all, who is Happy Pay Darian?
So first of all, Brian, you know I'm a huge fan of your show, right?
Oh,
so
thank you.
Sunday morning I get up and my first thing in the morning is grab my cup of tea, and it's Channel 9. So
nice.
I'm a program manager in Team System, and I work on areas like code analysis, the debugger, historical debugger, profiler. Pretty much the way I express it is, Brian, is whenever something goes wrong with your code, I'm there for you.
Nice,
so,
nice.
That's
awesome.
My job.
That's awesome. And this is actually your actual license plate, runtime, right?
It is. So when I moved from Australia to here, I actually went to the Department of Licensing, and it turned out this thing cost like $30. So I'm like, what a find.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah,
and
for
no
sure.
one else had it. Huh?
Yeah, nice. I bought it. So before we go on, though, I want to, a couple of times you've mispronounced my surname, so I want to actually,
for the
audience's sake, explain how you say it. So if you take the two words Hey and Darian and put them together, it's Hey Darian.
Hey Darian.
Yeah, so it's Habib Hey Darian. So
I will probably botch that again.
I know you will.
That's what, we can get Michael to edit that and fix it every time. So the Windows API code pack for the Microsoft .NET framework has hit version 1. So we've talked about this in the past. Basically a set of, I guess, wrappers is a good way to think about it, ways for you to build applications in managed code that better take advantage of Windows 7 features like jump lists and
sensors.
Icon overlay. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a .NET developer today, it means I'll be able to take advantage of the Win7 features.
Yep.
I don't have to, for example, use COM or C++. I'll be able to just use C# or VB for that matter.
Right.
To be able to take advantage of those features.
Exactly. And the nice thing about this is that it doesn't just support Windows 7. This supports Windows XP and back
versions. Oh, great. I didn't know that.
As well. So it gives you a lot of different wrappers all in one package for taking advantage of the various Windows light up features. So that's out on Codeplex.
That's awesome.
So Yahoo's API is starting to shut down. So when we talked about MicroWho or Yasoff a few weeks ago, you know, we were speculating, and to be honest, we're still speculating about exactly what's going on here. This made it out to the Twitterverse this week. It's if you take a look at Yahoo's Developer Center, you'll notice that their term extraction web service is set to go offline at the end of the month. And I'm not a Yahoo developer, but I was taking a look at some of the forums, and it seems like a lot of people were using this. So something to be mindful of if you are targeting Yahoo's APIs, something to watch for. And as we get closer to, hopefully, if the Justice Department lets the Bing and Yahoo deal go through, then I would imagine a lot more of these are going to either be shutting down or redirecting to Bing services.
So do they have any suggestions in terms of like what you can move to or any of the new APIs that you can take advantage of?
I didn't see any suggestions on Yahoo's site, but there were some forum threads where people were discussing that.
Okay.
And there were some suggestions coming out of there.
Okay, great.
So, yep. So Spec Sharp and Boogie, these are some funny names. What's that all mean?
So let me share a story with you. So the first programming language at university that I used was Eiffel by the great Bertrand Meyer.
Nice.
And essentially Eiffel, the biggest thing that had going for it was the fact that it had what they called contracts built into it. The idea behind contracts is that, you know, Brian, when you're writing code today, there are several ways you can express what the code should do. You can write comments, right, that says the return value of this should be blah, right? Or you can actually have a separate document on the side that says this method does X, Y, and Z, and I expect it to do, you know, A when it does this other thing.
Right.
Wouldn't it be great if you could actually bake the intention into the source code itself? So the idea behind Spec Sharp is that now you can have your C# code that you can essentially have those intentions in your source code. So let me describe to you what I mean by that. So let's say that you have a divide method, right? And in that divide method, you know that, you know, the divisor should never be zero.
Of course.
So what you want to do is that as part of a precondition, that means before I do anything in this method, I want to be able to say, you know what, divisor should never be zero.
Right.
And if it is, then throw an exception.
Right.
So that's exactly the idea behind spec Sharp is that it's a superset of the C# language.
Okay.
And essentially allows you to have specification within your code.
Gotcha.
And the three specifications that you can have are a precondition, a postcondition, and what they call an invariant.
Well, now, what's an invariant?
The idea behind an invariant is that it's an expression in your program that never changes. So I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. For example, a person's age, right, is always greater than zero.
Sure.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
It's therefore an invariant.
Yep.
There's also something called a loop invariant that basically means that at the end of the execution of each loop, these conditions should be met.
Okay.
Essentially.
So gotcha.
You can find out a ton more on Wikipedia and various mm-hmm. other things, but I think this is a tremendous step forward. And I think what's even greater news is that as of .NET Framework 4.0, mm-hmm. Spec# is actually part of the .NET Framework.
Nice.
And they've actually called code contracts. And being me being a code analysis guy, that's tremendous news, because one of the things that I always try and push is that I want to basically help developers mm-hmm. to push quality upstream as much as possible.
Sure.
So if you can essentially stop people introducing bugs to begin with, great. You know what? I'll be out of a job. But
exactly.
And then the other part that I want to talk about is this boogie thing, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say you went ahead and defined your contract mm-hmm. by putting in precondition,
yep. divisor can't be zero.
Exactly. Yep. Well, you still need something to verify that for you, right?
Sure.
So that's where Boogie comes in. So the idea behind Boogie is that once you've defined your contract, then this thing actually runs over your code. It's mm-hmm. actually a formally, it's a program verification tool that says, yes, your contract is actually valid.
Got it.
Now, the cool thing here is that when it integrates with Visual Studio, there's this amazing scenario that happens, right? So now let's say you as a developer are trying to consume my divide method, mm-hmm. right? And you actually want to pass in an argument of zero as a divisor, right? Mm-hmm. IntelliSense will now put a squiggly underneath your method saying, you know what, you cannot call divide with a zero. So it actually stops you from doing things in the past that the only way you'd find out is through a runtime exception.
So what happens if I try to pass divide with a variable x,
mm-hmm. right?
X could be zero.
Right.
I don't know, but does Boogie then pick that up?
Absolutely, and that's
wow.
the idea of the program verification tool
yeah.
is that it basically takes your source code. Well, the compiler takes your source code, it compiles it to some intermediate form, in this case CIL, mm-hmm. and then you have Boogie actually work on that CIL mm-hmm. and do the verification and actually tell you that you're doing something wrong. In this case, trying to actually breach a precondition
without checking. So I should be saying if x is zero, then tell the user they can't do that, but if not, then go ahead and call the divide method.
Right, exactly.
Got
I mean,
it.
When you think
yeah.
about it, you do a lot of defensive programming today. Like mm-hmm. asserts is a good idea,
sure.
right? Whenever you have, at the beginning of a method, you basically have things like assert that parameter foo mm-hmm. is not null. I mean, that's a very common scenario. So mm-hmm. now with the code contracts as well as Boogie, that is all done for you. I love automation
wow.
when it comes to source code.
That's
so
awesome.
It's a great, great thing. I'm really happy. So hopefully I'll still be here in a year's time. I won't be out of the job, but
keep
I'll
a couple bugs around just for Habib.
Thank you.
So the news here is that this is available on CodePlex now.
Yep.
You can go get it. You can start using it today.
Yeah.
So awesome. That's really cool. And great explanation. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So Expression 3 mm-hmm. RTM'd a few weeks ago, and it's available for you to download as an MSDN subscriber, and they just released these Expression 3 starter kits. Now, starter kits, traditionally, I think of the ASP.NET starter kit.
Right.
It's like personal website starter kit. Let me give you a framework of an app mm-hmm. to build, iBuySpy, that sort of thing. These aren't exactly starter kits in that sense. They're more like training kits. The idea is that they'll give you some assets to start a project, they give you some documentation, and they give you some videos to say, hey, here's how you can check out like the new super preview features of Expression 3. Even though they're not starter kits mm-hmm. the way that I think of them, they're still very valuable and something that if you're getting started with Expression 3, it's a good thing to check out.
Yep, that's a great thing to for all those who are starting with Expression. I think
yep.
it's a really good tool.
Exactly. So so speaking of Expression, so we're talking about Silverlight now. This is an interesting article that came out from this guy, V. Bandy, or guy or girl, I don't know. It's not a full name here. But the question was, what are the stats on Silverlight 3 deployments? You know, mm-hmm. it's been out since this summer, Microsoft, as far as I know, hasn't released any official numbers around Silverlight 3 deployments, but you can take a look at some of those websites out there that track this sort of thing, and if you take a look at it, the number of computers with Silverlight 3 installed is estimated to be right around, where did it go? Is it 24%?
This is an exercise in reading. Yeah. 23.25.
23.25%. And the number of machines with Silverlight 2 is down to only 8%. So as you're thinking about what version of Silverlight 3 do I target, or what version of Silverlight do I target, it really is ready for Silverlight 3. Incidentally, Silverlight 1 is down to 1.5%. And 23 may seem like a low number anyway, mm-hmm. but the reality is that's every single device that's hitting these websites. So that includes a Windows mobile device that doesn't even support Silverlight,
right.
Or I heard Apple has a phone.
Yeah, that, it's off hard, yeah. You know. It starts with an I something.
Yeah, something.
So, answer the question, can I jump to Silverlight 3 now?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's a quick download. Even if you only already have, even if your users already have Silverlight 2 to Silverlight 3, it's painless.
Right.
So, so one last fun thing for Silverlight 3. This is Charles Petzold, of course, author of many books, and he put together this cool sample that uses the new Perspective 3D features of Silverlight 3 to create kind of a ripple effect for photos.
Right.
So
cool.
Yeah.
I love that tat, man. I need to get one that says runtime right here.
Awesome. So Greg Duncan brings us a link to SQL cheat sheet. So did you work on Link back in the day?
Not quite, because I was on the C# group, but I didn't actually get to work on Link. But I can kind of say I was associated with the C# team that worked on Link.
You were linked to the Link team.
Hey, that's a great way of putting it. So I like it. Yeah.
So this is nice. It's just another one of those nice little cheat sheets if you're doing a lot of Link programming. Mm-hmm. Nice to have this at your desk. Shows you how to do lots of different statements. And if you're a cheater like me, it's a good thing to have.
It's called leveraging, bro.
Leveraging, exactly. Thank you. Good spin. You should be in marketing. So so we've talked about SpecSharp as a way of documenting your applications and making your APIs, you know, self-documenting, I mm-hmm. guess. But if you're not in a position to use SpecSharp, here's some tips on actually documenting your source code. So when did you learn how to document?
I think it was CS 101, and the way I would document my code would be, this is variable X.
Yeah. Thanks. That's really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you get credit for it. Because your teacher says, you must have documentation. Check. And you move on. And I don't see anywhere. I mean, I'm sure there's places you could find that teach you how to write good documentation. But it's not sort of a part of our upbringing as programmers, mm-hmm. right? And so I really like this just because Gunnar Pittman, and I'm sure I'm messing up his surname too, basically goes through and just puts together a one-page simple list for here are some things you should think about as you document your source code.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep. So what can you tell us about this guy, historical debugger?
Okay, so this is my baby right here, the historical debugger. As Brian mentioned previously, I've covered the historical debugger pretty much, you know,
every week for
every
the last,
week now. Yeah. One of my missions for the rest of this year is to actually blog every day about the new features of team development. So, but getting back to the storyline here, in this article, what I'm doing is I'm covering how you can debug exceptions with the historical debugger. You know, one of the really nice things about WPF and ASP.NET is that if you do something bad, like don't catch an unhandled exception, ultimately there's a global exception handler that eats the exception for you, and therefore the application
doesn't crash.
You know? But on the downside, one of the bad things about that is that as a developer, you want to know about those exceptions,
sure.
right? So this is one of the great benefits about the historical debugger, and what I'm showing here is that using the debug history window, you'll actually see the exact sort of events that happened that got you to the exception. And then, when the exception happened and it was handled, mm-hmm. what happened afterwards, right?
I see.
So it's a great way to understand both how did I get here and what mm-hmm. happened once I actually handled the exception, or when ASP.NET or WPF handled the exception for you. So again, I think it's one of those things where I really hope with the historical debugger we're going to be able to reduce the debug time, you know, from hours
sure.
down to minutes, hopefully. Like, where you can just say, there's a problem.
Yeah,
I know what the actual issue is. So,
and for people who may not be as familiar with the historical debugger, my favorite feature or my favorite capability is the fact that your testers can run this.
Right.
They can have this trace enabled, and then once they hit an issue, maybe mm-hmm. they don't understand what's going on, but they file a bug. The developer picks it up. Boom! You've got the historical debugger trace file. You've got everything right in front of you. Actually, is it a trace file or a log file?
So we're still finalizing the branding,
okay.
but you can call it trace file or log file. But the idea is basically you have a package that
yep.
you can hand from, you know, a tester to a developer, and then they'll be able to open that package up, the log file or trace file, and say, you know what? There's a problem right there. So
awesome. Good stuff. So definitely subscribe to Habib's blog. So an introduction to UI automation here. So speaking of testing and debugging your applications, this is really interesting. I enjoyed reading this article. It basically talks about the hidden, it's not hidden by design, but a lot of people don't know about this UI automation library that exists within the .NET framework. And so, you know, one of the things we're doing with VSTS 2010 is we're giving you the ability to write automated UI tests that actually go through and drive your application and click things and actually pretend like it's a user, right, so you can test to make sure everything's right. But there may be times when you can't use that or just can't afford to wait until Visual Studio 2010. So this is one way to do it where you're literally writing code that drives the mouse pointer, that drives clicking certain buttons or accessing certain window handles and causing your application to do things. Before the show, we were talking a little bit about when you would actually do this. And a friend of mine named Morris, he actually has an ISV that he makes an application called Windows Tabs. And Windows Tabs is all about, automatically grouping windows within your application or within your desktop to kind of organize your desktop.
Got it.
So you open up a few windows and it groups them together, kind of like what Windows 7 does,
right,
but on a much bigger scale than that. And he wanted to make sure that if you are always opening up new windows and closing them and rearranging them to different groups, and if you just have long running processes, that there's no memory leaks,
right,
that the application's not going to crash under heavy load and so on and so forth. So he wrote some UI automation tests that basically open up new windows, they drag them to different groups, and then he can keep these running over an extended period of time, and then he can come back and check them the next morning and say, hey, how much memory is my app consuming? Do we have any crashes? Mm-hmm. Let me look at the log. And it saves him a lot of time by actually being able to test that, as opposed to having to, pay people to actually go out and click buttons or have his own time spent doing that.
Yeah, one of the main issues with actually testing UI is the fact that it's non-deterministic a lot of times, right?
Yeah.
So if you can actually codify what you want tested in UI, that would be a tremendous benefit, because that means you can just rerun the same code over and over again and not have, did the person delay 2 seconds before they clicked on that? Is that why the issue happened? So
right,
you get rid of a lot of the issues that you typically would if you were just doing manual testing of UI.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Yep.
It's great.
So great article there. Mm-hmm. So Visual Studio themes. So have you played with these yet?
Not yet, but I'm really anxious to find out whether it supports my kind of themes. Like, I used to use Emacs.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Back in the day, yeah. So the idea is that, with the new WPF shell that Visual Studio 2010 is based on, you can really customize and tweak things to your heart's content. This is actually a theme from Rob Connery. What he did is he first made everything high contrast in the editor and changed the colors for variables versus, classes versus whatever. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that he did that took that a step further, he's actually turned off a lot of the helper windows and, across the top you've got debug, test,
right,
all those different
yes,
windows, right? He turned all those off because he just said, my job as a programmer, I spend 90% of my time in code. If I need to turn those things back on to do something, I can do that, but I need to optimize my job for being in code. And so there were a couple of nice themes that you can actually download that floated around this week that we'll link to.
You know what'd be really cool, Brian? You want a theme designer.
Yeah, that would be sweet.
So with I think maybe even with VS 2010, we have this great extensibility framework now for UI. Maybe someone out there could write a theme designer
that
for
Visual
Studio.
That would be awesome. Or ship. Here's one.
Okay.
So I went to the University of Florida, as you may have heard.
Yep.
I'm a big Gator. I would love like a Gator
theme. Oh, there you go.
Awesome, so.
That would be awesome. Like, you have all various sports teams.
Orange and blue, exactly.
Man,
yeah.
Now that's a great idea.
Yeah, so someone needs to build that. You can sell them for like 99 cents, whatever.
There you go.
So Beth Massey.
Uh-huh.
So you work with Beth, right?
Yep.
And she wrote this article on basically building WPF applications that integrate with Office. So
what's the idea here, Brian?
Well, let's say you're building, let's say you've got an Excel application, right? And you want to build a form that's a front end to actually load data or process the data that's sitting in a worksheet. Mm-hmm. And you want to build that in WPF.
Okay.
That's one thing you might want to do. Maybe you want to build an Outlook add-in or a Word add-in. But basically, Beth works on a team that goes through and finds ways to bring managed applications into Office and have them interact. And so really, when you think about the average Office worker, Office is probably the application that they use 90% of their time.
Yep.
And so if rather than building applications that are completely standalone and separate from the Office experience, if you can build applications that interact and use their data right within Office, then that's a win for everybody. And so Beth has this five-part article that she links to. All the source code's available. It works with Visual Studio 2008. I just thought it was a great article to link back to.
Yeah, that's great. In terms of, I mean, WPF is a very rich, essentially, client API that mm-hmm. now you can use in to build Office applications.
Absolutely. And you can debug them with the historical debugger.
There you go.
So licensing.
Open source.
Yeah. So I don't know about you, but when I got into software, I didn't expect to become a sort of legal expert on licenses. And I think a lot of people, this is kind of a necessary evil, right?
Yep.
But as you know, the world becomes more open and more of our code starts to involve open source contributions, you really have to understand what you're getting into from a legal perspective. Speaking of Microsoft Word, there's that whole court case where the judge made an injunction on Microsoft Word that we can't sell it. I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on there. No word for you. But Zach Rustin here goes through and he kind of, is it Rustin or Rusin? Rusin. Okay. Sorry, Rusin. I'm always messing up people's surnames. It's terrible. Zach, I'm pretty sure Zach's right. Zach put together a table that basically lists out various open source licenses and gives you kind of the high level, you know, pros and cons of each. One license that he missed is the MSPL mm-hmm. license, the Microsoft Permissive License. But that one's pretty straightforward. Actually, right. Anyone can sit down and understand that one. Don't take this for gospel,
right.
But when you just kind of need the high level, hey, which license should I even research further? I think this is a nice handy dandy chart to refer back to.
By the way, do you know whether we use MSPL on CodePlex? Is that what CodePlex is?
So CodePlex allows you to use several different licenses.
Okay.
You can pick. Many of the licenses that CodePlex allows you to use are actually in this list.
Okay.
MSPL is one that we recommend, and it's something that we stand behind. But there's other licenses that are approved as well. I believe that CodePlex used to let you use whatever licenses you wanted.
I see.
But eventually they've standardized onto a common set.
Okay.
So. And so this is just in the just for fun category. So this is Thomas Lewis actually sent this to me. There's a, you know, back in CS 101, we learned all these sorting algorithms, right? You learn the bubble sort and you learn the, I'm not thinking of the rest of them, the bubble sort, the
shell sort,
integration sort, yeah, all these different
all
sorts.
All the other
right?
ones. Good Lord, I got to take a CS101 class.
I know.
Again.
Well, now we've just got the collections library.
I know,
you
that's
say
the problem.
Dot sort, right?
Exactly.
But these guys actually went out and they said, what happens if we actually assign musical notes to these sorting algorithms? And so it's kind of fun. You can actually hear what a bubble sort sounds like and hear what, you know,
does
the other
sound like
sound
bubble
like.
Bubble bubble.
No, it didn't actually. It was I believe it's an inappropriately named sort now because it does not sound like a bubble.
I see.
I'd imagine if you assign the right notes to it could sound like a bubble. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. And top secret feature, we're actually going to enable this in the .NET framework 4. So anytime you call collections and cause it to do a sort, we're actually going to play out of your PC speaker.
Is genius. Just like when you hit a breakpoint today, you can actually play a sound.
Yeah, you've got
Same thing.
Made a blog post.
Yeah.
About. Yep.
I love that idea.
So speaking of things that I love, picks of the week.
So yeah, as you know, Brian, I'm a pretty huge fan of building applications for robotics.
Mm-hmm.
And this site here is called Hello Apps. And one of the things that I typically see on news groups and forums is how do I get started with programming for robots?
Right.
So this HelloApps.com website is a great, great resource to get started with building apps for robotics. And especially it's designed for the Microsoft Robotics Studio. That's something that we actually ship. And I love it because it has a ton of resources. If you don't know anything about robotics, for that matter, or if you know a lot about robotics, it's a great way to ramp up on Robotics Studio. It has simulations, it has books and videos and everything else that you can ever want to actually get started with robotics. So,
nice. Very good.
I'm a huge fan of robots. Go robots.
So what kind of robots are you building? Can you tell us about it?
I've got a couple of secret projects that I'm working on.
Nice.
It's going to be a multi-billion dollar business that I'm investing in right now. So I might let you know in about a year or
if
two.
If this turns out to be another segue, I'm going to be very disappointed.
Damn it. It's already gone.
So my pick of the week is that you can pre-order your Zune HDs. And I realize that this is not applicable to people around the world. But if you live in a locale where you can pre-order a Zune HD, it's looking pretty sweet. I'm excited excited. I use my Zune all the time for radio, and so I'm excited for the HD radio support that's coming to it. Touchscreen, you know, all the things that that you've read about. We were trying to figure out before the show whether or not this is going to support XNA, and you know, we don't know anything.
Right.
We have to assume that it will support XNA. Right. There's a lot of speculation that you'll be able to support XNA. The graphics chip that's in these Zune HDs is pretty sweet, so you should be able to build some really awesome applications with it, assuming that it does support XNA. But we've got our fingers crossed, waiting for that announcement.
Brian and I were talking about the fact that it'll be great to see a white paper that says, you know, essentially what's new for developers in Zune HD, and you know, various features. It's like, this is how you can take advantage of feature X, Y, or Z.
Yep, so exactly. That would be a great thing. Email my friends in the XNA team. I'll see if I can get a scoop, and maybe we'll have an update for you later.
Yeah, great.
So that's it. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Cool. And you ready?
Yeah. We'll see you next week on This Week at Channel 9.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Bye, everyone.